Why don't we start, if you're ready?
Sure.
Just by having you say your name and identifying yourself.
Yes, my name is Jan Novak Jezioreński. The Novak is the nom de guerre, and my real family name is Jezioreński.
I'd like to begin with you telling me where you were and what was happening in your life. At the end of the war.
Well, I was the first survivor of the Warsaw Uprising who was sent as an emissary by the Polish commander-in-chief of the Underground Army and of the Warsaw Uprising to London with microfilms, with the archives of the Uprising. And the first one who reached London on 22nd of January, 45. And of course, I did work for some time with the Polish authorities, debriefing them and also British and American authorities, lecturing, writing, until I was hired by the Polish section of the BBC in 48. And that was the beginning of my radio career. Excuse me. I was trained in my profession as a broadcaster by the BBC, and I stayed with the corporation until the end of 51. And then I was appointed the first director of the Polish service of Radio Free Europe in Munich. And I had to organize the entire operation, all-day operation, from the scratch. I was the first Pole who was hired. And my job was to recruit people, to organize the operation, to create, the schedule, the programming, and all that, unfortunately. So I started a sort of a second chapter of my life with Radio Free Europe. And this was probably, from the perspective of my life, the most important job I had. Much more important than during the war, because during the war I was an emissary and I was very active in the Polish underground movement. But as an emissary, I was rather a witness. An eyewitness of the game between Moscow, London, Washington, and I saw the moon from both sides, from the perspective of London and in Warsaw. But I cannot say that I did really influence any decisions or events. While in the radio, we learned really that we have much greater influence than could have been expected. I feel, and this is what the audience say, including such people as Wałęsa or opposition leaders, that we did have a considerable impact on the development in Poland between 52 and 89, when Poland was liberated in a way. So this was my most important period of my life.
I want to talk about that. I'd like to go back to the just at the end of the war, where you were,
Yes.
and what you were doing. I understand you were arrested.
I was only once arrested by Swiss authorities when my wife and I illegally crossed the border. I was very lucky. I was never arrested by Gestapo. If I would be arrested Gestapo, I would probably not be here. But I was very lucky and never really fall into the hands of Gestapo. But when we crossed the border near Basel, we were immediately caught by the Swiss border guards and arrested.
What year was that?
This was the end of 44. It was just, the end of 44 and the very beginning of 45. And under pressure from British, we were released by Swiss and allowed to cross into France, which was already liberated. and from France by the military plane. We were taken to London.
So when the war ended, you were in London?
I was in London.
And can you tell me what
well,
was going
as I told you already, I was, my job was really to tell British and Polish about the situation in Poland, the history about the Warsaw Uprising. This was the time before Yalta and before the formation of the puppet Polish government in Warsaw. So we were at that time deeply involved in a very desperate struggle to really prevent what happened in Yalta. In other words, to rescue the independence of the country. And that took me my first years in London. And I mainly was focusing on what was going on in Poland. I was a kind of a advisor to the Polish exile government, which still existed.
And where were you living for the brief period after the war?
In London.
In London. How long did you live in London?
Until the end of 51. In other words, I spent 6 years in London.
And how would you say your life changed after the war ended?
Well, unfortunately, I was an exile. All my plans, my objective, I did want to be a scholar, an economist, and I was just on the point of finishing my doctorate thesis when the war broke out. That was all lost. I had no chance and no wish even to return to my scholarly career. Frankly, you know, the objective was how to regain freedom for my country, and that was the main objective. And there were only two ways of doing something. One was to try to influence public opinion in the West and the governments in the West. And that was very difficult at that time, because immediately after the war, still some kind, the hopes existed that wartime friendly relationship with Russia could continue. And the second was to try to influence and educate people in Poland. And the only way of doing it was by radio, because in Poland there was a monopoly of media in the communist hands. And the only way people could learn truth and learn about even their own situation was by listening to foreign radio. So it suited me very well to join BBC, because I had a chance to broadcast to Poland. Although the contribution was negligible, because the British really did not allow so-called exiles to make any major contribution. Most of the programs were written by British, and our job was simply to translate it into Polish and to deliver it.
I could interrupt you for 1 second. I'm going to readjust this. So for those 6 years, you were working for the BBC in London.
No, I was working for... No, I, for the BBC, I worked from... since 48 until the end of 51, for 3 years.
What about the years from 45, the end of the war?
Well, I already told you that I worked for the Polish government in exile. I mean, this is the answer. I mean...
Okay. When was the first time you went back to Warsaw?
After 45 years, first time I was in Warsaw at the invitation of Lech Wałęsa on the 10th anniversary of the Solidarity, of Solidarność. And that was at the time when the first non-communist government of Poland was being formed. So it was, I was there, I went to Gdańsk to see Wałęsa on 20... on 30 of August, 89, after 45 years.
Can you tell me what that was like?
Well, it was a very moving experience. For 45 years as the director of Radio Free Europe, I was on the top of the blacklist as the enemy of communism. And of course, I could not go back. And I was convinced that one day Poland will be free again, because I sensed that the Soviet system has so many inherent contradictions that sooner or later these contradictions will bring down the system. But I never hoped that it may happen in my life. And it came unexpectedly, really, and without bloodshed. And the people felt that Radio Free Europe did make a considerable contribution to this bloodless liberation. And so I went privately on the board of, I believe it was TWA plane or Pan American plane, and didn't expect any welcome. I thought some members of my family would be at the airport, but I didn't know that Radio Free Europe did broadcast the news of that I would be in Warsaw and the time of arrival, the plane. So after 45 years, the plane, I touched again the Polish soil. I was very moved. I saw the terminal with this Warszawa, Warsaw. And I saw many people, crowds of people on the terrace and around the building. And I asked myself, why, how's it? I mean, it's Tuesday, a weekday. Why they should be there? And when we were going towards the exit, two Americans were behind me. They said, there must be a VIP on the boat, because a group of people are waiting in front of the plane. That was for me. And the entire leadership of Solidarity was in the front of the plane. And I have fantastic welcome by these hundreds of people who came to the airport. And the next day, the hostess, my hostess, offered that she will take me to the downtown, to the city. And I said no, because after all, I was born in Warsaw, and I would like to see my city alone. I said, you will have a problem to find the taxi, because they don't stop. You have to find the taxi stop. I said, okay, I will manage. I went to the main street, and here was a taxi. So I raised my hand, and the taxi stopped. So I jumped in, and the taxi driver said, I know who you are, because you are on television on the evening. Okay, he took me to the place which I requested, and the fare was laughingly, it was 27 cents because of the dollar was very high. So I decided, no, I will give him a dollar at least. I gave him a dollar and said, keep this dollar for yourself. I said, why? How much? He said, nothing. Why nothing? Because I was listening to Radio Free Europe for so many years, free. I want to offer you one free drive. And that was, to me, very moving. This $1 was the best reward I got for 25 years of work in RFE.
Did you go back to your old neighborhood or your old home?
No, the Warsaw was destroyed. The house where I lived was rebuilt, but the place where I actually lived was non-existing. So that, no, I could not find any of my old places.
Did your visit to Warsaw bring back memories
of
the
war? Oh, yes, definitely.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, you know, this was the city when I spent my childhood. my school, times of my high college, and where I spent my the time of my underground activities until I left for the West. What more can I say?
Was it, were they, the memories, was the feeling positive or?
Well, there was a feeling of tremendous happiness, really, that I can be back in my own city and among my old people.
In 1951 is when you began working for Radio Free
Europe. Radio Free Europe, yes.
Where were you?
Well, I moved to Munich. I got the housing there, and since that until...
I was asking about your move to Munich.
Yes, well, I moved to Munich. It was December 51, and took over my job and was organizing the Polish service. I was involved in recruiting people, dry run, training them, and organizing the program. The inauguration of our program was on May 3rd, May 3rd, 52.
Did your experience in the underground help you in your job as head?
Oh yes, well, it gave me a very good knowledge of the situation in Poland.
And you stayed as director from 1951?
From 1951 until 1st of January 76.
During that period, is there any one story or any one thing that you remember that stands out the most?
Look, I mean, there were so many stories. I wrote the book in two volumes that I cannot possibly single out one story. There were so many. It was a fascinating life, full of stories and full of, let's say, adventures, different kind that during the war. But they were adventures. After all, I had several fronts. I worked with the American management and had to argue about the policy with the Americans. I had my team, which was a very large one. At one moment there were more than 100 people. And finally, the main front was communism. I had to fight communism.
How large was your staff?
It started with about 80 people, but later on it was much more than 100.
And can you tell me a little bit about the programming? How many hours a day?
Yes, it was the only all-time programming. We did start at 5 in the morning, and we ended after midnight. It was a sort of a continuation of the free Polish radio, which did exist before the war. And we even adopted some features of the Polish radio. For instance, the program did end with the Polish national anthem. In the middle, we had in the Polish radio at noon, they would transmit the so-called Hey Now, you know, the very old tune, which was played by trumpeter on the top of the tower of the old Gothic church in Kraków. We did broadcast this. So, in fact, it was a kind of a substitute and continuation of the free Polish radio. And we had everything. First of all, news every hour on the hour. 10 minutes news, so that everybody in Poland knew that when, with the strike of an hour, he can tune on RFE and he will hear the recent news. There were, of course, political commentaries, roundtable discussions, press reviews, all kind of, you know, political futures, such as you find in the public radio or public television. But there were also the program for the country, for the village, for the farmers, and the program for women, program for workers. There was sport, musical programs, or everything that you expect from the normal Polish, normal home radio. This was, as I say, a substitute.
Were you yourself on the air?
Oh yes, but not regularly. I broadcast when something really very important happened. I did not broadcast every day or even every month, but when something of great importance happened, then I was on the air, and people knew that it was that there was something important at that time.
Can you give me an example of one of those times?
Well, for instance, in 1956, they were a big upheaval, really, and the Russians did. For instance, when the Polish primate was arrested, which was a big blow against the church, I would go on the air and make my comments about it. When they were anti-communist party upheavals in October 56, then I would make comments about it. So whenever there was something very important, I was on the air.
When you went back to Warsaw, you understood the impact that you had on
people's
lives.
Oh yes, because people were telling me.
How did you know what impact you had on people's lives in Poland during the time that you were broadcasting?
Well, in the first place, we did meet people who went to the West. Two, the most important indication of effectiveness were attacks, propaganda attacks by the regime, which were very intense, attempts to discredit us, discredit me, and jamming. I mean, jamming was a very expensive operation. And the jamming did indicate that they considered our broadcast as effective and dangerous. And finally, the Americans did have a contract with the major audience analysis institutions in Denmark, in Austria, and they were conducting, you know, public opinion polls among people who were coming from Poland. So we had pretty good indications of our effectiveness.
Yeah.
And letters, but we didn't attach too much importance to letters.
Did you stay in touch with any other members of the underground that you associated with during the war?
First of all, there was no underground movement after the war. There was for some time and was eliminated by the political police. But I had my friends, and some of them would, in great secret, contact me when they were in the West. So yes, I did. I was in contact with my old friends and associates.
Are you still today?
Oh, by all means, yeah. Even more. Because it's no longer any risk to anybody.
You talked about how your experiences in the underground gave you experience to do your job at Radio Free Europe. Can you talk a little bit about how you applied some of those experiences?
Well, first of all, I believe that I had a very good knowledge of people, of mood, of the situation. Therefore, I could build the program in such manner that it is best tuned to the mentality, interests, traditions of the Polish audience. And something I could not do in BBC. In the BBC, British were deciding what to broadcast and how. Here, we had Americans gave us a considerable editorial autonomy. They believed that only three poles know how to broadcast to their compatriots. Therefore, I could use my knowledge of the audience to to make broadcasts as effective as possible.
When did you come to the United States?
I did come to United States in November 77. I spent almost 2 years in a sort of we had a small house in Austria, in the Alps, past Thurn, lonely house with beautiful views, and we spent almost 2 years there, and I wrote my book called Courier from Warsaw, which was later published in underground in Poland and here in United States in English, then also in France, in Holland, in Sweden. And we spent this 2 years' time, almost, not quite, simply to, I wrote my wartime memoirs.
And you moved to the United States?
In November 77.
And why did you decide to move to America?
Because I felt that I still was not old enough to retire, that my personal friend, Dr. Brzezinski, was the director of National Security Council, and I did decide that I could serve my old country by being here and by trying to influence American policy towards Poland and my part of the world. This was an ideal place, close to the administration, to the Congress, and with, as I say, with few influential friends.
That was Zbigniew Brzezinski.
Was one of them, yes. Mm-hmm. But you see, people whom I knew in Radio Free Europe when they were very young, in the meantime, they had high positions in the American life. So I had a lot of contacts.
What was your position when you came here?
I became the consultant to the National Security Council, and I was the consultant until the present administration.
Can I ask you about your personal life, meeting your wife and
Well, we met in the underground. She was a liaison girl. She was very active in the underground. And when I came back from my secret trip to Sweden, I brought with me the mail in microfilms. And the liaison girl who came to pick up this film was my future wife. This is where we met. And we were married during the Warsaw Uprising with the enemy lines only 100 yards from the chapel where we married. And since that, we are staying together. It's 52 years.
Have you had children?
We have no children.
Did you leave the Polish-American Congress at the end of the Bush administration? Have you no longer?
No, because the Clinton administration no longer continued consultants. There were no consultants. I was de facto consultant, and I'm still in daily touch with the NSC, National Security Council. But I'm no longer on the list of consultants.
I wanted to ask you how often you think about the experiences during the war and in the underground. If there are certain things that trigger your memories, music or food.
No, because frankly, I wrote my memoirs. I wrote my two books about my career in the radio, and I hope to can put it behind me. Unfortunately. Then I had interviews and people asking, But I prefer to think about the present time and about the future rather than about the past. It's not very productive to live in the past.
So you feel as though writing your memoirs helped you move beyond?
I hoped it will be, but the people like yourself come and ask about my past.
You had said that your time at Radio Free Europe was the most important time.
It was definitely, by far, the most important. Frankly, you know, I never thought that the words as a vehicle carrying ideas and information may have such a tremendous impact. And first of all, frankly, we eliminated effectiveness of censorship because it was enough to tune to us, to learn everything that the censorship was trying to keep from preventing to know, to learn. So we destroyed the monopoly of media, the monopoly of information education. As long as this monopoly existed and people were isolated from the outside world and flow of information, they could have been brainwashed. But once they had access to free sources of information, they remained independent in their own mind and in drawing their own conclusions. That was our role. Also, we did play a role of an opposition, and I discovered that the ruling group fights the opposition by doing what the opposition wants them to do. In other words, the criticism, when it is widely known, government reacts to the opposition. They don't want people to believe in what they say. And therefore, they try to prove that you are wrong by acting exactly like you want them to act. Our first rally, probably it was the most important event in the history of political broadcasting. After Stalin's death, and after Beria was killed, a very high official of the Polish political police, who had knew all the secrets, all the state secrets and party secrets, defected to the West. And after being debriefed by the CIA, we could use him. And he was broadcasting all the secrets of the party. And the entire Poland was listening. And they had to find scapegoats because he was revealing all kind of crimes committed by the leadership. In order to defend themselves, they put all the blame on the political police, and it was reorganized completely. And the resulting chaos decreased the terror. You know, people were no longer afraid because the entire apparatus of the repressions was paralyzed, and it was because of the effect of Światło that opposition in Poland could become much more articulate, they could speak, they could in a sense organize themselves, and that was our major contribution.
I was curious how you at Radio Free Europe dealt with the issue of anti-Semitism?
Well, you see, right after the war, I believe that anti-Semitism was pretty dormant. But the regime, which was under great attack from the West for violating democratic institutions, for forging the elections, in a way that they want to compromise the Polish people, and there are strong suspicions that so-called Kielce pogrom was instigated by the political police in order to, you know, compromise the Polish people. But in fact, the sad part of the story is that this kind of provocation, if there was a provocation, did find a fertile ground. There was people who did the fact, historical fact is that 42 innocent Jews who survived the Holocaust and lost many of their relatives and friends were murdered by the Poles in Kielce. And this is something that I myself, as a Pole, I'm very ashamed of, and I believe that we should, and we did, Poland did apologize for it. Then, you know, there was a anti-Semitism made in Russia. Stalin was anti-Semitic, and shortly before his death, he arranged so-called doctor's plot, accusing his doctors of Jewish background of plotting against his life. And that was a signal for kind of anti-Semitism that was instigated by Russians in order to divert the attention of people from their poverty, from the inefficiency of the communist regime, and to find a kind of a scapegoat. Jews were to be scapegoats. And this was the kind of anti-Semitism spread by the Stalinist faction called Natolin in the Communist Party. And they were opposed by intellectuals, liberal intellectuals. And among the intellectual elite, there were many Jews. And this is when we first really started to fight against anti-Semitism, 54, 55, after Stalin's sudden death, when this was the means to compromise liberally minded Jews who were in opposition to the party line, to the party system of work. And there were some very outstanding intellectuals who were opposing this kind of anti-Semitic trend, and we did a lot to support them to compromise the anti-Semitism as something that is imported from Russia, since the people at that time hated Russians. This was probably the most effective way of fighting anti-Semitism. We did dedicated a lot of time and work to it.
You had a lot of programming.
A lot. Scripts, they are still in existence, scripts.
I think you had said in the other interview that your time in the underground was the most fascinating time of your life.
It was fascinating. Well, in the underground I had adventures. This was a wartime adventures. In Radio Free Europe, it was much less romantic. We were simply broadcasting, writing program.
What is your attitude now toward Germany?
Well, first of all, I hate hatred. In other words, I am strongly against the idea of eternal enemies. The Germans inflicted terrible, blows to Poland. They not only murdered most of the Jewish population, but about 2 million Poles were killed in the concentration camps. They were executed or deported, and the years of German occupation were the years of terrible human tragedies. So, frankly, you know, of course I had very strong feelings against the Germans. But After the war, when I was in Germany, I discovered that you cannot generalize, that there are also some Germans who are decent and who would like to, frankly, compensate in some way for what they did to the Poles. Well, this is probably a postman. Yeah, I can do it later. And the only problem I had with the Germans is their territorial claims against Poland, which were extremely dangerous to our existence because Poland was moved westward. We lost one third of our territory and our people who were annexed by the Soviet Union. And we were compensated by the big powers in the West. A considerable part of former Germany was incorporated into post-war Poland. We couldn't possibly lose it again. We would be then a sort of a remnant state. And so this was the main problem between the Poles and the Germans. But in 1990, Germans recognized the border as final. It was ratified by the parliament. And as of that date, it was a turning point. And once the Germans reconciled themselves with the post-war borders, they are no longer a threat. And there is a tremendous improvement in the Polish-German relationship, which I'm very happy about, because I believe that hatred is a boomerang. If you hate other people, they will hate you. So the reconciliation between Poland and Germany, which is very real, is probably the best achievement of this solidarity government.
When you see that kind of hatred in Bosnia and other places,
terrible.
What does it?
Well, you know, this is, you know, the hatred brings about unspeakable human sufferings, loss of life, tortures, everything. Senseless. So ethnic hatred and any kind of ethnic or racial prejudices are extremely dangerous to humanity and to everybody, including to Poles also. So I'm very happy that Poland, after it got rid of its communist and Soviet domination, is working towards reconciliation with all its neighbors, with Germans, with Lithuanians, with Ukrainians, Czechs, and so on, and restored all the minority ethnic rights to its ethnic minorities.
In the video interview you did, you talked about how angry you were that it was a crime that the world didn't do more to stop the Holocaust, that it didn't.
Absolutely. Listen. You know, this was my very tragic experience because, frankly, I was again an eyewitness. Of course, the Jews were isolated. They were behind the walls. But I could still see the starving Jews who would escape from ghetto and die on the pavement from starvation. So it was a tragedy, a human tragedy without any precedent. We did lose 2 million ethnic Poles, but only Jews were really condemned to death simply because they were born Jews and had no chance to survive. And I was the first envoy who brought this information about the Holocaust was my colleague Jan Karski. And then I followed. I was in Stockholm at the time of the uprising in the Warsaw Ghetto. And I knew about it, and I wrote a memorandum to the Polish government that they should exert an influence on the British, that some kind of retaliatory measures should be threatened to stop the extermination of Jews. And I know that the memorandum was passed to Churchill. But he was not prepared to any. The only thing is, I believe that my memorandum did contribute to the decision to prosecute after the war German Nazi war criminals, because soon after the decision was made to install the tribunal, and announcement was made that Nazi criminals will be brought to justice. Then I came back. It was July 44, and ghetto no longer existed, but there were many Jews in hiding. And I got instructions to prepare myself for my second mission to London, and to be briefed, to learn about the whole thing, so that I could again bring about some message about what happened to the Jews. So there was a man by the name of Wolitzki, who has his, plaque in Yad Vashem. He was the kind of a liaison with the Jewish militant organization. I spent hours with him. He told me all about the uprising and all that. He was himself in touch with it. And I got on microfilms the report of the survivor of the Jewish ghetto uprising, and also photographs, documents, which I brought in my secret post as microfilms. And I was the one who brought this report of the Jewish militant organization to London. I reached London in December 1943, and this report was passed by the Polish government to the British government, to the organization, and I did see many members of the British cabinet, members of the parliament, intelligence, people from intelligence community, and I was telling about what happened to the Jews. And frankly, as far as the British cabinet, there was no response.
Yeah.
And when I talked to Eden, Anton Eden, foreign secretary, he told me, "Mr. Novak, the best way and the only way we can help Jews is by winning the war. If we divert our limited war, military resources to such objectives as bombing the tracks, it will delay the end of the war." And, when I came back to London with my wife, when I was writing my memoirs, and we went to Her Majesty's Record Office, archives, I found piles of documents concerning my mission, including the reports from Eden to Churchill about our conversation. Not a one word about the Jews. Not one word. I talked to all of them. I raised the question of Jews. And I strongly believe that the retaliatory measures would have offered at least a moral help, that they would know they are not ignored, that the world sees their tragedy. So I feel that. But even Jews would not believe me. I mean, there was a Polish Jew by the name of Schwarzbart, who was in the Polish, sort of a parliament in exile. And he put me in contact with the American Jewish organization, Joint and others. And I spent hours with them. They didn't believe me. When I said that 2 million, at least 2 million Jews were already killed, they thought that this is unacceptable exaggeration, that I must have some political motives in right. telling this story.
It would seem that your frustration during that period made you more determined in your work later on.
Absolutely.
To see that changes occur.
Absolutely. I must say that I used this very powerful instrument, Radio Free Europe, to fight anti-Semitism. But also we did not generate hatred towards Germans or Russians. we were, you know, defending our national aspirations, but there was no purpose of really generating feelings of hatred, because I strongly believe that hatred is a boomerang that would hit the Polish people back. And I was at the time when, you know, there was again the outburst of party anti-Semitism. In times of a man who was in charge of political police, by the name of Mochar, and he was anti-Semitic, and he really unleashed anti-Semitic propaganda and the purge of Jews. There were many Jews in the government, many Jews in the all kind of position, and there were many Jews among the university youth. And he started a campaign of anti-Semitism, like in Russia. And by discrimination, by persecution, by threats, he forced this people of Jewish background, who considered themselves Poles, to leave the country. There was an exodus of young Jews who didn't even know they were Jewish. They were completely assimilated with the Polish culture. And they were Polish writers, Polish scholars. And this was, again, an unspeakable tragedy for them. And we were going out of our way to at least offer these people a moral help by condemning it. And I had a lot of satisfaction when, for instance, a Polish essayist and writer by the name of Roman Karst, who had to leave the country under this kind of purge, and he became a professor at, how is it called, Brooks? Stonebrook University. He came to me and said, "Mr. Novak, if not for Radio Free Europe, I and my daughter would have committed suicide. And we were on the verge of doing it. But your broadcasts made us believe that we are not alone, we are not isolated, that our, and the kind of moral comfort that we got by listening to Radio Free Europe, really, we decided, no, we will leave the country, but we will live on with all this." And this was for me a tremendous reward. There were my former colleagues, Jan Kott, who is a very highly respected American scholar, was my schoolmate. He was of Jewish background. And they were all really highly appreciative of our efforts. Also, during the Israel Six Days War, we were on the air from the morning until night. Israel embassy got, I don't know how many flowers, messages from our listeners. Mm. Because, of course, since Russia, Soviet Union, was on the Arab side, Polish people were on the Jewish side. So I think it was... I'm very proud of this effort, which under my leadership was undertaken by Radio Free Europe in fighting hatred and prejudice.
Do you think the world is capable of experiencing the kind of hatred that the Germans had and the kind of killings that they carried out during the war?
Well, Germans themselves did a lot to weaken this feeling. After all, they made the democratic Germany did not deny what they have done, what was done in the name of Germans. But they were trying to, first of all, make truth known to every German. And they were trying to make good for what these are things. Nobody can restore life to 6 million people. But they have done a lot for reconciliation with the Jews in Israel and in diaspora.
But do you think that the world is capable of you know, you know, you talked about your frustrations in inaction, and the rest of the world seemingly didn't do enough during the war. Do you think that could happen again? Do you think the world could stand by?
Well, you look at Bosnia. I mean, this was ethnic cleaning, which may be, perhaps was not a systematic murder in the factories of death, but nevertheless, people were being killed simply because they happened to be born Muslims or Serbs, but mostly... this is again the same tragedy. The world should really encourage, by every possible means, exchanges of people, personal contacts, reconciliation. And I am very happy that Polish governments, after the fall of communism, are doing their best to seek reconciliation with the neighbors, not only with Germans, but also with Lithuanians, for instance. So that before the war, Poland was at a war with all its neighbors, no longer so. And I'm very happy about it.
I want to ask you about one thing you said, that you thought your report to Churchill, I believe it was, helped with the investigation of Nazi war criminals. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, it was not a matter of investigation, because Germans were still occupying power, but against warning Germans about some kind of retaliatory actions, that if you don't stop this systematic mass murder of Jews, you will be punished. And I said, you bombed Germany anyhow. Why not to say, these are our retaliatory measures for what you are doing, for instance, to Jews? And that was not accepted, this kind of SOS.
I wanted to ask you about, you have these pictures around your living room of you meeting with, I think, every president from Jimmy Carter, and also the Pope and Lech Wałęsa. Can you tell me about those experiences?
Well, I really, as you said, I worked with all of them and with their staff. And I must say that all of them did play a very constructive role in restoring democracy in East Central Europe and in Poland. U.S. policy since the end of the 70s is a story of success. And I am non-partisan, and I believe that both democratic administrations of Carter, now of Clinton, and of Reagan and Bush contributed greatly to rebirth of democracy and regaining sovereignty by these countries. So to each of them, we owe some debt of gratitude. I must say that since the time of Woodrow Wilson, no other president did more to Poland than George Bush. And this is not my partisan view. It is simply that he got deeply involved in support for Wałęsa, support for solidarity, and then he made possible takeoff, successful takeoff of the free market economy by offering considerable assistance, economic assistance, by reducing debts. So I must say that I consider Bush, on the Polish sector, as the president who did a lot to combat the communism, for the overthrow of communism, and for installation of democracy and the free market economy.
Do you remember anything significant, that anything stand out from what these men told you?
I would have to to think about it. There were some stories. The problem is to remember them.